Happy New Year.
Good that we've made it, and trust that we are all doing as well as we could possibly be. Good to see your faces. I'm going to do a quick acknowledgement of the team that is here, the members that are here, and then as others come in, I will identify them as well. So let's go around the table, and I will begin on this side.
Yes, sir.
So start with Kevin.
Kevin Dolezal, I'm present.
Are you green over there?
I'm green. I'm Kevin. I'm green. I'm present.
Excellent.
Ramon Johns, present.
Awesome.
Sergi Ruiz, present.
Beautiful.
Jillian Suresh Felton, I'm right here.
You are.
Aquiles Montas, present.
John Washington, check.
Wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. It is great to have folks present. I mentioned last time when we gathered, we also, in creating this space, wanted to make sure it was as equitable as possible. And so access was important, location was important, timing was important, and then providing something for people in the evening to some substance for folks to enjoy and have access to. And so tonight we've got sandwiches and chips and cookies and beverage. For those who are remote, we've got sandwiches and chips and cookies and beverage, just putting that in the air. Glad you are here. On the screen, we have Tanisha.
Yes, good evening. I'm sorry I can't be on camera tonight, but I am here, Tanisha Renee. Good to see everyone. Happy New Year's.
Can't hear you. We didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Oh, you didn't hear me at all. Can you hear me now?
Saw that you unmuted, but we're not getting sound from the screen.
Can you hear me at all?
Tanisha, I can hear you online.
So
I
right
can
here,
hear everybody else.
Any
Dr. Holtz, it seems like they're working on sound issues.
Awesome. Okay. Well, we'll go ahead and begin our recording. Oh, okay. Fantastic. Thank you very much. If you have an agenda, we're going to stick to that tonight. You've heard me say this enough probably to repeat it with me. This is a meeting that's open to the public. It is not a public meeting. And what is meant by that is that you have the opportunity, the public is welcomed into the space to for a transparent and accountability to see the work that the Oversight Committee is doing. We are following the agenda that has been prepared for this meeting. And there is space for public comment and public testimony. We'd love to hear it. If there are concerns outside of this committee and outside of this agenda, I'm going to ask the members of the Portland Housing Bureau to identify themselves. Those who are on the screen, if you could turn on your cameras, that would be awesome. And then those who are in the room, if you'll participate by waving your hands. As well as on the screen, you can wave so people know who you are. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. These are the people you would approach. These are the folks you'd reach out to if there are concerns, again, outside of tonight's agenda. But you are also given space, about 2 minutes, for public comment where you can weigh in on the work we are doing. With that being said, we're going to go forward with our agenda tonight, and we'll begin with our director's update.
So Leslie and Tanisha have their hand raised, but I don't know if we're going to be able to hear them. Oh, okay. Leslie just nodded her head. Never mind.
Okay. I'm going to do my best, those who are hybrid, to keep my head up. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to keep my head up so I can see the screen. If you didn't hear, the screen we have to view from is connected to the ceiling. So I'll do my best to capture that. So with that, Ms. Helmy.
Okay, thank you so much. Good evening. Happy New Year. I'm Helmy Hisarek, the director at the Portland Housing Bureau. And I want to first acknowledge that I'm here tonight with the executive team of the Portland Housing Bureau. All four members of the team are here. Leslie Goodloe, who is the director, of our business operations and equity is actually on screen. She's usually here in person, but she's remoting in from a business trip that she's on. And so we're really glad that she's willing and able to take time to be with us. Deputy Director Angel Ladron Gonzalez, who's just taken a bite of his sandwich, is here this evening with us, I think possibly for the first time in person. And he's a new deputy director, so really so pleased to have him join us. He's been with the Bureau for several years. He's moved up from heading our finance and accounting team and is now really taking on a really important role overseeing a lot of our internal operations and finance work. And then online, we have Josh Roper. Josh, if you could wave your hand. He is the Director of Policy Planning and Research. He was just started with us about a month ago, and he's dug in, and he has an extensive background actually in homeless services and policy. So I just wanted to acknowledge that our whole executive team is here, and we're really here to listen to community and to be present in the North Northeast communities. Very, very pleased. And then, of course, we're joined by a lot of other PHB staff. I'm not going to name everybody, but I just want to say, you know, great team. My deep pleasure to work with the people at Portland Housing Bureau. I have just a couple of things to go over. The first is very personal, but I want to share with all of you that I moved to Portland just about a year ago from the city of Los Angeles. And so the last 24 hours I've spent paying attention to my family. My daughter still lives in Los Angeles, my parents and my siblings, as well as many friends, and really being online and paying attention to the devastating fire that has really completely changed me. And as somebody who works in local government, we have a responsibility, even though I'm not a firefighter, as a director of housing, you have a responsibility to show up during these kinds of catastrophic events. And this particular event, my family is fine. Nobody's been affected. Nobody's had to evacuate yet. But it has really put a fine point on the importance of us as city to be prepared for these kinds of things. And I really woke up thinking about, you know, what if something like this were to happen in Portland? What is my role as the director of Portland Housing Bureau, and how do we as a team engage? Because many of the people in Los Angeles have lost their homes. So I reached out to the fire chief as well as to the Bureau of Emergency Management just to reiterate the importance of Portland Housing Bureau being engaged in the response at the city level to catastrophic events like this. And I want to express ask all of you and express send my own prayers to that city, to the city of Los Angeles, and think about how appreciative I am that the state of Oregon has sent 340 firefighters to Los Angeles, and several fire trucks are driving down there now. So there's been this incredible response from a neighboring state, and also to really just sort of acknowledge that we're all in this together, and pulling together matters, and that it is a priority for me as a director and for our team to be available and be present for these kinds of things in Portland. Just a few things I've spoken about last month, such as the changes in the city. So since I was last here, the biggest thing is our government's completely changed. And we have all new elected officials. So we have new mayor, Keith Wilson, new council members. We are currently in District 2. And in District 2, we have three new council members, Samir Kanal, Councilor Alana Pirtle-Greeny, who was actually just elected as the council president, which is an important role. And Council Member Dan Ryan, who was a former commissioner and is reelected. So I think we have great representation in this district, and I look forward to working with them. I'm only just at the beginning phases of getting to engage with them and learn what the protocol is. So I'm sure more will be revealed as we come back and tell you how things are going. The city administrator, so I now report up not to a commissioner, but I report up through to the mayor through the city administrator. So I report to Deputy City Administrator Donnie Oliveira, and I am on a team with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, the Planning, Permitting, and Development, and Prosper Portland. So we've four bureaus all work together, and we all report to Deputy City Administrator Donnie Oliveira, and he reports up to City Administrator Michael Jordan, and Michael Jordan, who has been the city administrator, interim city administrator for the past year, has just agreed to stay on for another year. From my own perspective, I think that's really good news because there's so much change happening. It's nice to have at least one person stay the same for at least a year. I think he's still in an interim place, and so that will probably change in a year, but for now it's nice continuity. We are going to keep you informed about how processes at the city change. There's a number of processes that are changing. We're figuring out what goes to City Council. Right now, City Council will be taking policy matters, and we will take some budget changes to them, but they will not be directing departments. So we'll let you know how those changes affect our day-to-day life. And then lastly, I just want to acknowledge that the six new TIF districts are on the horizon for us. I don't know if we have a map of those TIF districts. Do we have one to share? I mentioned this.
We do. Let me pull it up.
I could put that up. I think it would be helpful to see. So the TIF districts are actually not in this particular neighborhood. There are three new TIF districts in East Portland, so the east of 205 district, the Columbia Park Rose district, and the 82nd Avenue area. So those three TIF districts are in the east side of Portland. And then in the central city area, we have the Lloyd Holiday district, the central east side corridor district, which is where OMSI is, and the west side district. So those three TIF districts are sort of there we go. Thank you. So you see they're in sort of three clusters. From Portland Housing Bureau's perspective, when we participated in the development of these districts, and the action that was taken at the end of last year was to actually establish the districts. So they were voted on by the City Council and approved. 45% of the revenues that are generated in these districts will be used for affordable housing. So that is significant. Over the course of the next 25 years, I think it's 25, these six districts will generate $1.1 billion in affordable housing funds. So that's a very large amount of funding that will be directed towards housing development. None of those funds are going to be available for the next 5 years. Right now, what we're looking at is entering into deep engagement with each of the communities of the TIF districts to develop action plans. So Portland Housing Bureau, together with Prosper Portland, will be doing a deep community engagement, building up action plans, five-year action plans, so that as soon as the funding becomes available, we will actually have some programs to implement. So this year we view as a year of community engagement and planning together with the community, building on the kind of community engagement you've been leading here and all of you have been engaging in. This is the model that I think will be informing how we work within the community. So that's it. Just a lot of change in the city and some very exciting opportunities for us to really deeply dialogue about the future of housing in Portland.
Well, thank you, Director. If we can go back to the gallery's view, thank you very much. Questions from the Oversight Committee for the Director. I'm going to start with you, Tanisha. Do you have any question or comment?
Do not have any question or comments at this time.
Wonderful. Well, now we can hear you. Glad you're here. Saylee, welcome to the meeting.
Hi, sorry. I was having some car trouble.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Any question, or did you hear the director's report? Any question or comment?
No, I just logged in.
Okay. Well, I hope you're safe.
I am. Thank you so much.
Excellent. Thank you. John.
Happy New Year, Director. And again, I share some of your common interest about those fires down there. I have a daughter down there myself, so, and family. And so, yeah, respect, man, you know, about the firefighters and them doing what they do. You know, when I was a young man, I always wanted to be a fireman, you know. But, yeah, those three new TIF districts, you know, 5 years is, seems like a lifetime away, but, you know, I'm sure if it's for a lot of you youngsters, it'll be lightning, you know, and when it's upon us, and well-deserved out there. Anyway, you know, it's time for some accelerant to go on, but again, District 2, we still need some fuel to get us to the finish line also, so I'm going to keep my eye on it all.
Thank you, John. Achilles.
Just question, how do they come up with a 5 year and not a little sooner? I mean, I understand that they need to collect the revenues, but maybe 3 years? Five seems a little long.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Tax increment is funding that comes from property taxes. So it's incremental increases in the tax value. So it's a little bit of revenue every year. Once you establish the district, you establish the base year. And then all the incremental increases after that of property taxes are what's going now into a fund. And the reason why 5 years is you actually have to, when in 5 years, there will be enough knowledge about how much tax revenue there is to create a bond, to bond against it. So they basically need to show that there's taxes flowing and to issue a bond. There will be some small amounts of funding, you know, relatively small amounts of funding that can be used prior to those 5 years, but it won't be until 5 years that you see significant enough funding to actually start investing in the millions of dollars, as opposed to, you know, 50,000 or 75,000. It'll be small numbers until then. I think it's our hope, and we're talking to Prosper Portland to see if there's any way we can try to leverage things earlier by working with the state to get some early money in. But we don't know at this point and can't make a promise.
Mm-hmm. Jillian?
Yeah, thank you. The new TIF districts are really exciting. If memory serves, the percentage of revenue that went to housing in the North Northeast TIF district was much higher. And I'm wondering if you know what the reasoning was for bringing it down or establishing at 45% instead of the 60 or 70%, I think it is in North Northeast.
So I'm sorry, I don't know the percentage in North Northeast. And
Leslie commented 70%.
70%, thank you.
Yeah, it was 70% for housing and 30% toward economic development.
Leslie has her hand raised.
Ms. Goodlow.
I was just going to jump in real quick because I know Helmy's not been here to know the history of the districts. So initially, the set aside was 30% across the whatever, however many districts we had. And that was an average of 30% across the districts. In 2015, the council did what we called the TIF lift, and they increased the average to 45% across the districts. But because Interstate did not have sufficient housing, given the promises and the significant displacement, it was deemed that the set aside for Interstate for the remaining years of the district would go up to 70%. So 70% of the remaining revenues would come to PHB and for housing, and 30% would go to Prosper for economic development. And so when you look across the old districts, it still is not quite 45%. We still have some money left in a couple of the districts that we have projects that will fill that out. I think it'll be about 43% average, 42% by the time all those districts are done. But this will, for the new districts, we're setting the actual amount currently at 45% across each district. So, and part of that will be us doing community engagement around what that set aside should be and if it should be different in some districts than in others. Make a recommendation to the new council about what that should look like. So it could be in Lloyd District that the set aside is 30% because they don't need as much housing, but in 82nd it should be 60%. Mm-hmm. And that gets us to the 45% across, you know, as an average. So that's part of the work that we will be doing over the next year to determine what that set aside should look like in each of those districts. So hopefully that answers your question, Jillian.
It does. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Leslie. I would just kind of reemphasize that in addition to the six action plans, the other policy that we will be doing community engagement around is the housing set aside policy. So how much of the tax increment funding will be set aside for housing? And that's a 2025 activity for Portland Housing Bureau.
Excellent. Any further?
Yeah, I had one more question. So in that 5 years, while the districts are establishing what the cash flow is so that you can bond against that cash flow, is there the opportunity in the latter part of that to start forward allocating or to start working to start the process of finding projects? It can take 5 years to get your full capital stack together. So it sounds like a long time, but in affordable housing, you know, that there could be a project ready to go. But My concern is that we start working with development sooner rather than later. I'm afraid if we wait 5 years to start, then it will be another 5 years before we start building, and then another 2 years before that's built. And then actually we're 12 years out from having housing.
Yeah.
And so I'm just curious if it's allowed under the statute, and if it's something that PHB is considering to look at a way to start forward allocating and building that pipeline of projects.
So it's an excellent question. Thank you for that. And I cannot answer the question of whether it's allowed in the statute. What I can answer is whether PHP is looking at it. We, just as an example, we did brief Council Member Loretta Smith on the East Portland TIF districts just a few days ago. She asked the exact same question, wanted to know how we could move things forward more quickly. And we absolutely made the recommendation that we should be doing advanced work so that we can begin land acquisition site clearance ahead of time. And seeing that was what my reference to working with the state. She had some really interesting ideas about working with the state to essentially move faster, start earlier. So I think what we're hoping to do is get through the action planning process. So at least we have an action plan in place. We know what the priorities of the community are. And then as soon as we know those priorities and we're ready to move, we're going to start to take actions to fund things in advance so that we're setting it up. So we're not starting in 5 years, we're actually acting in 5 years. So thank you for that. Appreciate the question.
Great. That's great to hear. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Virgie. I'll come back to you. Thank you, Ms. Virgie.
Yes, I'm really pleased to hear this. And I'm really happy that we are involving the community people. I think it's really important that as we got started on this oversight project, we started inviting community input. People came, and that's how we became a committee, and that's how we got the work done. So I'm really excited and looking forward to this new change in government, change in how the Housing Bureau, and also the projects that they'll be working on. So I think we do need time, and especially getting policy in place and some other people up to, being informed and helpful in getting these things into place and more housing.
Thank you. Thank you. Ramon?
No questions.
Okay. Kevin?
Glad to hear your family is safe. I think one question you mentioned, I think the four departments now rolling into the city administrator, I guess, could you share just quickly, like, what is that change and kind of what do you see as the biggest, I guess, opportunity in that across these different teams?
Yeah, thank you. I think what Portland voters wanted in the change of government was a more functioning government. And I think part of being a functioning government is bringing communities together with the government, but also bringing the departments and the bureaus that need to work together. In the past, there wasn't that alignment. It was very siloed. So each individual bureau sort of had their blinders on and did their thing, but didn't necessarily collaborate. Now we're in a structure that actually forces us to collaborate. So the directors and their staff, is it still on? Okay. The directors and their staffs all have to actually talk and align. This actually came to fruition just recently. I didn't announce this in the presentation, but I'll share with you that we were notified yesterday that we were awarded a $7 million grant by HUD that was called the Pro Housing Grant. It's not yet accepted by the city. We haven't yet gone through the process, so I don't want to go into too much detail on it until we can get it all, you know, locked down. But that particular grant not only was led by the Portland Housing Bureau, we did the writing and pushed it forward, but it actually funds activities in the housing production plan. And the activities are being done, it funds activities in every one of these bureaus. So we actually reached out to our partner bureaus and said, what part of this plan do you need to get funded? And we put it into this. So this is actually a grant for the entire service area working together. And I think that's an example of when you can talk to each other quickly and collaborate, you can do things that are not in a silo, but actually working to strengthen us as a team. So I think that's a good example of the kind of changes you're going to see going forward.
That's a big lift and a massive adjustment. John?
Just one last question. Maybe I might have not heard it. Does this committee have oversight in those other TIF districts also, or no? So you'll form another one of these in those districts also? Okay, thank you.
My question is, when we did our presentation before city council, the prior city council, one of the things that has become extremely identifiable is that our affordability has to change, because even at 60%, families are still rent burdened. And so I made the suggestion that we look at 40% units, we look at 50% units. As we're doing this new TIF, as we are doing the new TIF districts, has there been any movement around affordability?
There has not been. First of all, this is a really important issue in Portland, and we are definitely listening and paying attention to it. We think it's the low income housing tax credit system has a kind of formula that everyone has followed, and we think that formula needs to shift so that we can get deeper affordability. We have not discussed it within the TIF districts yet, because all the conversation so far has been around the formation of the districts. Are we or aren't we not going to have a district? What are the boundaries of the district? Which parcels are in the district? But the action planning process, so now that the districts are formed and approved, the next step is to form advisory bodies and to do the housing and economic development engagement with community. What is it you want and need? And I think that is going to be the time when we dig in and really understand what levels of affordability are needed in each community to truly serve the community.
Well, I appreciate that. If we can, by any stretch of the, if there can be any contribution from our committee, let me just flag that deep affordability, we know it's an issue. We know that Black and brown people are cost burdened, rent burdened, even at 60%. And so if there are ways to make that part of the conversation, then we strongly encourage that. So thank you very much, Director, for your report. Appreciate it. John. I believe you were up, sir.
Thank you. Good afternoon, the recent committee members and staff. Normally, to put on the PowerPoint, that'd be great.
Hey, John, we're having a challenge with your audio and you're freezing.
You hear me now?
Yes, I could hear that.
Great, thank you. Apologies for not being there tonight. I am at the Hacienda Home Ownership celebration.
Okay. Very nice.
Great. Thank you. Norma, can you put on the PowerPoint? Thank you. Okay. My name is John Trinum with the Neighborhood Housing Preservation Manager, the City of Portland Housing Bureau. I will be presenting on the preference policy homeownership updates. Next slide, please. So from the last time we met, which is November, we actually had a home buyer that closed in December before Christmas. So we're very happy to see that happen.
Awesome.
So to date, we have 128 families who became first-time home buyers since the time we started. Our goal for by the end of 2029 is going to be 200. So as you can see from this graph, the majority of the home buyers are in the North Northeast area for 39 new home buyers. Next slide, please. The demographic of the home buyers, so 117 utilized some of our subsidies. The previous slide had 128, and those were purchased home in the area but didn't use subsidies. With the folks who use subsidies, 86% are Black, 7% are white. And you can see the graph, they have 1% for Native American, multiracial is 3%, Asian is 1%, and Hispanic is 4%, 3%. Next slide, please. It was great to see this home buyer, when they purchased the home, they were at an AMI of about 45%. So again, really low AMI. With the chart here, you see the majority of the home buyer were at 60 to 80% AMI. The next percentage will be 81 to 100%. We also had a 27% at 101 to 120%, and under 60% AMI of 5%. Next slide, please. So we with the new preference policy, we have some upcoming session with Portland Housing Center for our folks who are on the preference policy, and they're coming up in January and February. So we continue to work with Portland Housing Center to get folks trained and educated, and we review their credit, review their budget to make sure that they're ready to become first-time home buyers. Next slide. I think that's about it, I believe.
Yes, that's his last.
Yeah, that's the end. John, real quick question. Do we have it for the January session?
Do we have what? I'm sorry?
Date for the January session.
I apologize, you got cut off again.
January info session, is there a date? Frozen.
I believe it's... I don't have that, sorry.
Okay. If you could get that to us, that would be awesome.
Sure.
Thank you. Any questions from the group here for John? Jillian, any questions?
No questions.
Awesome.
Actually, Christy could be able to answer that question for you.
Hi, John. Thank you. I'm happy to answer the question about the info session dates. I'm Christy Gifford, and I am the Preference Policy Home Buying Specialist over at Portland Housing Center. So I am leading those sessions. We have four of them scheduled in January. We just had one This Monday, so it was Monday the 6th at 6 p.m. They're all from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. And in the sessions, we hold an orientation. We are able to get everyone registered and scheduled for their first intake appointment, which is really nice. The next one will be January 15th.
John, if you can mute, that would be awesome. Thank you.
The next one is January 15th. Yeah, thank you, Leslie. The following week on the 22nd, and then the last one of the January session is going to be January 27th. These are invite only as far as the 6-point cohort applicants coming in. So people will have gotten correspondence from Portland Housing Bureau and will have responded to an RSVP, and Portland Housing Center, us at the Portland Housing Center, get that list, and then we arrange the info sessions based on that.
Thanks. Yeah, very much so, and I'll tell you why I'm asking. There is much conversation in regard to our processes, from how we go about doing or how the process is working. And so I would love to start capturing data that that's current data. And Portland Housing Center, you guys do a great job with this. How many folks are on the list? How many people are showing up? Contacts and so forth and so on. I just want to support or be clear on how our processes are operating, how the policy is functioning. There's just much consternation around it, and it would be great to have accurate data to be able to process appropriately. So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Appreciate it. John, no questions for you, my friend. Go back to your celebration. Good to see you.
Thank you all.
All right, moving on to our next topic, and that's...
excuse me, Dr. Holt, real quick. I'm sorry. Before you move on to the next item, I just want to say in regards to data that Ira does an amazing job of collecting data, tracking each applicant. We track from the preference policy team, from when people apply, how many notifications they've gotten, those people that were verified, and then that list moves over to Ira, and Ira then contacts people and gives them opportunity to attend the session. So he tracks each person when they got, when they're being notified, and then who goes onto the list to then go over to Christy. So we do have all of the data on our side. Excellent. For the contacts. And so if there's any person that says, hey, I'm on the list and I don't know what's going on, they can reach out either to me or to John Trent or to Ira, and we can find out what's going on, when they were, what notifications, or if they've just not been notified because they are in the 5-point, 4-point, 3-point cohort. So it could be that people just, we haven't gotten to them yet, and that's why folks are concerned, but we have to start at the top.
Thank you. That's great information. I appreciate that. And I did not ask Tanisha or Saline if you had any comments or questions for John. So forgive me for that.
I don't have any comments. It's really wonderful to hear that somebody was able to purchase. So that was great.
Thanks.
Yes, I agree. No, I don't have any questions.
Okay. Thank you very much. John, go celebrate.
I just want to mention that we do have another home buyer within the North Northeast closing this month with using Prosper Dollars. So we're Come excited on. To get another home buyer.
Thank Come you. On. Fantastic. Yes, please. Come join us at the table. We're moving forward to our preference policy updates. Hi, Divisha, and Happy New Year.
Good evening, Dr. Holt, and good evening, committee. I'll be presenting the preference policy update for rental housing. Oh, I forgot I don't have to hold it. Good. Okay, if we can go to the next slide, please. So what I did is I took all the applications that have been submitted since January 2004 to 2025, and we had a total of 3,008 applications submitted. That is an unduplicated number. So some duplicates may be accounted for in that, but I just like to show that number so we can see that there is always interest in it. People are aware of it. And some folks have been on the list previously, but they reapply because new opportunities present themselves and they move to where it's affordable. Next slide, please. And then here I have the breakdown by point cohorts. I always like to just take us through a little bit of an explanation of the preference point cohort. By now, I'm sure folks who've been on the committee for a while have heard this enough, but just for the public, so the way the point cohorts work, it is essentially based off geography, where a person and or their ancestors lived within North and Northeast Portland is essentially what determines how high or how low they are placed on the list. This is based and closely tied to Inner North and Northeast Portland. As we know, it's within the ICURA, and it is the points are determined by how much urban renewal activity happened within the area where those individuals lived. I just always like to have that there to ground us, and so we know what we're here for. And as we see, we have 246 families in the six-point cohort. We have 758, I'm very happy to see that, in the five-point cohort. We have 204 in the four-point cohort, 264 in the three-point cohort, 252 in the two-point, 132 in the one. And as we know, zero is always a larger number. We have 1,152 in that point cohort. Next slide, please. I promised you last November that I was going to provide you with a security deposit update. We don't yet have a comprehensive report to provide yet, but I wanted to provide you with something just to bring us all to this on the same page about what this is about. The Security Deposit Grant Assistance Program is a partnership between Rental Services Office and the Preference Policy Team. What it is it is supporting the individuals on the preference policy list by covering through financial assistance by covering moving costs. So moving trucks, childcare, security deposit, hence the name, and any other fees that may be incurred in relation to moving. It was off to a shaky start. There was confusion or disconnect around promotion. Whereas we were sending the folks, letting people know a little bit about what it's about. We leaned heavily on partners to promote. However, it was right and rightfully so brought to our attention to create some sort of flyer, so to speak, that they can provide to folks as they are meeting with them when they do their initial intake interviews. So this is when they're going in to apply, when they move from the preference policy list to actually being contacted by the housing provider and at the appointment to actually apply. So that's a lot of steps in between and opportunities for us to inform them about the program. We have tightened up a bit. A lot of trainings have been provided to kind of go over what the security deposit is about, letting housing providers know that it does not just cover security deposit, it covers other moving costs. Very pleased to say, I don't have a list of the buildings that do it, but there are a few of our partner buildings that don't charge security deposit. Hence, it's being underutilized and it not being as well known among some of the recipients. That, of course, caused a little frustration on the part of, most importantly, the community member, the partners, and us. So we did have a wonderful meeting via email and discourse with one of our partners, and out of it came a flyer and, of course, trainings. I will say it has picked up. We have used a significant number of the funds. I'll go into the quarter breakdown in the next slide. So if we take a look at the first quarter, in the first quarter, we only had about 25 families that received rent assistance. Most of the referrals were going to Alberta Alive for the Dr. Darrell Milner building. And then we had a lot of individuals who had their security deposit assistance applied to their rent. We are seeing a bit of diversity in how the funds are being used. So hopefully we'll be able to bring you more in the comprehensive report and how that's being used and how this could be a program that's expanded. or test it out more, whatever direction it goes based on what leadership decides. In the second quarter, we have 17 more families that received grant assistance. We had a little bit more diversity in how and who those funds, in which buildings those funds were going towards. So we still had Dr. Daryl Milner building. We had Cascadia BHC for Garlington Place, which I am very pleased to say that was one of our first proactive applications of it, meaning the person received assistance before moving into the housing. Just to take a step back, part of the disconnect also was finding the point in which to start the process to assess where the person is needing assistance and also getting them moved in time, because it's a short window. Most folks are, one person reported having maybe like 3 days to kind of come up with their security deposit, and of course, all the other moving costs that are incurred. So it's good to see them apply it more proactively. Central City Concern, which I just did a retraining with their team, Charlotte B. Rutherford, last year actually, for Charlotte B. Rutherford was also where another family came from. So far, a number of 42 families have been served, and about 44,000 of the funding has been spent, and we have a total of 56,000 available. From there, we will be to conduct the comprehensive report. We're going to have some interview. We had some surveys, actually. That's what came first, to assess how the program was going. That was led by our partner, United Way. A big shout out to them. Ari and Linda have been putting in work to make sure that families are aware of this and supporting them through the process and getting their invoices paid for any services that they were using. Before we start our comprehensive report, we're going to be doing interviews with at least 10 families to see how the program goes and to get more insight into how we can make it better. And from there, we'll have more updates to report in the next session, which I believe is in March. Next slide, please. All right. Thank you for your time. It's a short presentation today. Any questions?
Well, thank you. We will go back to our gallery view, and I'll begin by asking if any of those who are with us hybrid have questions or comment. Tanisha?
No questions.
Okay. Saleh? Not mute,
buddy. Sorry, none for me either.
Okay. Thank you. Let's start on this side. John?
Maybe we're a little slow to the uptake on some of this stuff, so you might have to bear with me, sis. So I'm going to ask you a series of questions because I'm curious about something. What you said about the waiting list. So when people get on the waiting list, right, that doesn't indicate anything that except for they're on the waiting list, on the list, right? So, and then each of those people on the list needs to be vetted, right? Yes. Go through the process of qualifying and all those things, right?
Yes.
So with 3,000 people being on that list, and now, and maybe I'm not aware, there is asset out there, meaning there are places to place people available in a lot of the projects that are out there, right? So I'm just having a hard time understanding with 3,000 people on the waiting list, and there is asset out there that's not bringing in any money and costing people. Right. Is there a breakdown somewhere in your mind, or I'm just not understanding that? I'm asking that question to try to figure out why are some of these projects losing money while there's asset and people waiting to get in places?
I think that's a more than appropriate question, and it hinges on what was touched on a little bit earlier. I'm going to, of course, ask Leslie to chime in, but affordability is part of it, and also the slow wait to making sure we're sending folks who are interested in the housing opportunity. It's not uncommon for us to send a list of folks. We send up to try to send up 10 families per vacancy, right? It's not uncommon for us to send the notice to folks or to make the referrals to the buildings, and it not yield the results that's needed. What we've heard back is affordability. We started a process midway last year where a initial kind of touch was being sent by reference policy stuff just to garner interest before we even share the list with providers. We've had some ticks with that because the timing given to respond, there was some questions and doubts about that, but I digress. The issue therein lies is a lot of folks are reporting, well, I want to be in this building, but I need something cheaper. That's mostly what's come up. I don't want to just beat that horse and have that be the narrative, but that is what we're hearing back. And that does cause a slow pace in the list.
Leslie does have her hand up.
Yep. Thanks.
John, that's a really great question because, I mean, the first thing is you've got 1,100 zero-point folks. So that means those are people that have not lived in Northeast Portland. So if you pull those out, you've got about 2,000 people that have some connection to Northeast Portland with varying degrees of proximity to city action. So generally, when we get a request, somebody says, oh, we've got a vacant unit in X building. It's this size. It's whatever. We send them 10 names, or if they've got more than one. And we have to continue to send them names of people until either somebody says yes and it works out and they qualify, or it gets to the 90 days and they can request a waiver. So we are finding that a lot of people on the list can't afford to move into a 60% unit. We don't have enough 30% units. And so they're over income for a 30% unit. There's not enough voucher units. A lot of people are on the list. They don't want to go off the list because things might change for them. But they're also looking for a voucher unit, which is a different process. We can't use the preference policy to lease up units that have project-based vouchers. Or the unit that's available, the person at the top of the list might be, you know, have three kids and they need a 3-bedroom unit, but the units that are available right now are 1 and 2 bedrooms or studios and 1 bedrooms. So we're really working to increase the amount of data that we have on our side, thanks to Divisha, Ramon, and then the new person we're going to be hiring in the next couple of weeks, to ensure that we are doing a better job of matching people on the list with units that are coming available. And so we are going to pilot a different process. We've tried it once and we're going to work with one of our development partners where they send us the information saying, we've got a 3-bedroom, a 2-bedroom, a 1-bedroom. This is how big it is. This is what the rent is. This is the AMI. And then we send it out to folks on the list. And then those people that respond saying, yeah, I'm interested. Can I, you know, can I schedule a tour? You know, can I, what's the next step? Then we only send those names over to that development partner. So they're not having to go through person after person after person who may not be interested because they need a 3-bedroom and only a 1-bedroom is available, or vice versa. The other thing is that we are going to be doing a review of the preference policy. I think I talked about this like last fall, to see what pieces we can change or should change and how to tweak some of the implementation so that we have better results. But, you know, and as Divisha and Dr. Holt have said, a lot of this comes down to affordability in these buildings and that, you know, a 60% unit is out of reach for a lot of people right now. So hopefully that answers your question, John, between myself.
Well, partially it does, Leslie and Aisha, and thank you very much for that. But I find it rather ironic that there's an affordability problem within affordability development. There's an irony in that. I mean, you know, we're building these properties to address this issue.
I agree.
But I think,
let me say this about that. Yeah. One of the things that we're dealing with is the cost of living increasing without the cost of income keeping up with it. And so deeper affordability is necessitated. And I think that's where we come in to advocate for that deeper affordability. We can't be satisfied because it is a conundrum. It's absolutely, it's an oxymoron. It's contradictory to the very work that we're doing, creating these places, and we can't get people in them because they can't afford them. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, I think it may be an example of the tip of the iceberg, the potential for that, because at the rate of development, and then looking at the existing asset and seeing that the asset is under, how would you say, under
occupied,
underperforming,
yeah,
would be more appropriate.
So, John, one other thing that I'll mention that's in relation to, you asked about buildings losing money. A lot of these buildings still have people with significant outstanding rent. At one point, I think it was like last December, not December of 24, December of 23. And I don't know how much of this has been cleared up, but between our six buildings, there was almost $1 million in past due rent across six buildings.
Yeah.
And, you know, the folks not wanting to evict people because they had past due rent, but at the same time, struggling to keep their occupancy at a rate that it's not going to impact their financing, their situation with their credit deals, all of those things. So it is a balance between supporting our development partners and supporting those community members that I have heard from. You know, I hear a lot from people, as does Dr. Holt, as does Divisha. You know, I have heard bait and switch more in the last 10 years than I think I have heard in my whole life, where people think we did this and it's not really what we said it was going to be. And so really trying to fight against that notion, and how do we address it? How do we make things better so that folks can afford to live in these buildings and move back into Northeast Portland. Albina Vision is, they have a building that's going to be open sometime this year, early in 2026. And they're fundraising in order to lower the AMI on many of their units so that they can rent at 40% and 50%. And I think that that's some of the things that we need to be looking at as Helmy mentioned, as we are looking at future projects, is how much subsidy does any building need? And do we subsidize at a higher rate if they're, you know, where's the money going to come from to subsidize at a higher rate? And then if people don't pay their rent, how do we help those developers stay on their feet? So there are units available in buildings. We get notices, you know, every, you know, couple times a month, there are buildings available, but struggle to find people off the list that are able to move right now, or that can afford the rent, or need a different size unit. So there are a lot of factors that are at play.
Yeah, and I would agree with that. And thank you for that. Without unpacking this thing any further, but it makes me very uncomfortable because of some of the other dynamics that I'm understanding. And you know, sometimes when you build at a crisis, at a need, and when needs are driving the project, the need, right? Housing is a need. So it's right away. Let's drive. And a lot of times, even with the business sector, we, you know, for certain demographics, we don't go in and do the research before time. Sometimes need just drives us to do something, right? To perform somehow. But then once we've done that performance, the reality of the fallout of that, we is in hindsight, it's almost like the time when we recognize as developers, you're saying, okay, we're building these buildings, but now we got to go back and build handicap access because we didn't take the time to consider that handicap needed to be built, considered before we build the building. And I'm thinking that a lot of this is happening in this process also. And one of my biggest concerns is are we building just to build? Are we building the population to meet the building? You know, there's some questions that I'm having, especially around mental health and the social services. You know, are we building the community, the people in the community, as we're building these buildings, or are we just building buildings? You know, and then hoping we can find some people to fill them. You know, and so I believe that this whole low-income, affordable housing reality is a bigger picture. I don't think it's just the housing itself that we're considering. I think it's the community in which those occupying as well. Some of the rest of that conversation and now at this point in time, but it, you know, I'm starting to see something and a reason to start talking at this on this panel and trying to figure out some of these questions, because the things that I'm hearing, I'm just tired of just sitting here being fed information and seeing numbers and seeing things and acting as if I'm ignorant about what I'm seeing. So I'm seeing some things, and I think I'm seeing them on the bigger picture out there because of the fact that affordable housing, as we build it and all the federal dollars that go into the affordable housing, I'm starting to recognize that some of these affordable housing developments are losing money. And some of the issues in which you're telling me about, it's part of the issue of demographic. And I'm going to be careful when I say this, but I say this jokingly and humorously. When I say baby has kids, you know, you know, the demographic, we bring it, and sometimes if we don't move the demographic as quickly, it becomes part of the project, you know, and there has to be a stimulus to move that demographic through there. So when you get that recidivism or that long-term occupancy with that, it starts to create a culture. And what I'm starting to see within that culture, if there's not movement or stimulus in the demographic, it tends to saturate and create blight. Rather, it's coming out and people not paying their rent, crime, safety, all of these other issues. So anyway.
Thanks, John. Yeah. I appreciate it. Helmy, you were going to respond. And then I don't know if Leslie had anything else she wanted to add to that.
I'd like to actually say that this particular problem is actually a problem if we can find the solution to. It's calling a question. It's calling a very important question. And what we realized was that the housing that was being built in North Northeast was the developers are unable to how to provide housing to people in the preference list. And we as a bureau were asked to give an exemption, exempt the developer from using the preference policy list and just try to fill the building. And at the bureau, Leslie and Tyvesha and I discussed it. We said, no, we're not trying to give exemptions. We're trying to actually take people who are sitting on the preference policy list and get them into housing. And we need to solve that problem. And when you talk about are people building buildings as for buildings, to be fair, the developers are competing at the state against a lot of other projects to get their funding. I said earlier that low-income housing tax credit financing is a formula. It's a formula that relies heavily on 60% of AMI. And so they're all competing in this world to try to get funding. And in that competition, they're not getting points for doing deeper affordability. So my thought and our thought at the Bureau is we're going to continue to press on this issue about deepening the affordability. Leslie's right. We're going to have to find the funding to address that. It's not going to come without a cost. But if we stay on this topic and we work to achieve this, to address this particular crisis, without the preference policy, we wouldn't even be aware of this problem. So I have to say, even though it's a problem, it's a good problem for us to try to go after. And so I really appreciate the work of the preference policy team. And frankly, I appreciate the dialogue with the developer community and the tough conversations that Leslie's been having to have, finding resources to try to solve this problem. We want to stay in this fight and in finding a solution for the very reasons that you're talking about. We don't want to be building buildings just because we're building buildings. We're building buildings for the community of Portland and specifically for people who have been displaced from North Northeast Poland to try to create and rebuild community that was lost. So I just want to sort of reiterate that we're here to commit to that engagement. And the team that you're talking to are very much oriented towards finding a solution. And actually, I think it's a good fight for us to actually be in and be aware of.
Thank you, Director. I appreciate it. And I think to piggyback on the thought, John, I think it'll be good for us to have just a meeting where we begin unpacking some things. Maybe it's not a public meeting, it's a private meeting, but we definitely need to spend some time unpacking some stuff and working.
I was just going to second that. I think we need to have a meeting on this conversation. This is an issue that's boiling my blood and is very, very concerned because it's like John said, we're building buildings just to build buildings. And these developers are just building and they don't care about their community, destroying our neighborhoods. I'm seeing it in North Portland and they're destroying our neighborhood. I have mentioned to the committee, there's one area where it's a side street and they're already building an 8-story high apartments, condos. How could that be possible? How could the city allow that? And the pricing is not gonna be affordable for our community to believe in and is very angry.
Appreciate it, Achilles. Jillian. Yeah, deep breath.
Okay. I wrote a lot of notes down. So hang in there with me. I'm going to start at the beginning. My first thing I wrote. So a 60% unit currently is about $1,800 a month. The difference between a 60% three-bedroom and a 50% three-bedroom is about $300. So at 50%, that's $1,500. It makes it a lot more affordable. I know that there is not currently a pot of money to buy down that rent in a voucher-style way, but this is a situation that it is a money problem. Throwing money at the problem will solve the problem. And identifying how we come up with that pot of money is, I think, the issue. It has to be on the rent side. We cannot give a project, let's say, $2 million to buy down their loan. Because not unlike with any mortgage, if you pay more principal, your payment stays the same. The same is true on an apartment building. So buying down the loan balance without a refinance won't help. So really, it's got to be on the revenue side. And I just want to suggest that as we have this new city government coming in and we have a new way of looking at things, that this is something that we prioritize to make it work for the people it was intended to work for. There are clearly, if there's 3,000 people on the wait list, there's clearly interest. It's about making it affordable. So again, the difference on a three bedroom, so let's just call it $300 a unit to get to 50%, $600 a unit to get to 40%. And roughly using those numbers, it's not a small amount of money if you take all of the projects. Do they all need to be at 60%? Is there no one in the preference policy that's at 60%? I don't think that's true, but we could certainly make some sort of dent. And I think that it's a policy issue and it's a funding issue. And it was an error to we as a city and metro area, when those bonds were passed, we created a situation where we incentivized having 30% units and 60% units. We could have incentivized a more blended rate by saying we want an average AMI of 45%. And then projects would have come in with 60 and 50 and 40 and 30. But that's not how the legal language was written. The legal language required this percentage of 30% units and then assumed everything else at 60 would subsidize the 30% rents. And so it's, again, I'm coming back to, it's not, I do not, I don't think that we can put this on the shoulders of the developers entirely because it was a policy issue. And we would not know were it not for the preference policy and giving it a try that this is the issue. But now we have to come in and figure out how to reach these. But as we're talking about new TIF districts, let's take the lessons that we've learned and let's apply it to our new TIF districts. Let's not just say we want this, you know, X percentage of 30% units. Let's say we want to target an average AMI of 45. We want a mix of units. We want every building to have 30, 40, 50, and 60% units. So that's the first suggestion that I have. I want to keep a forward look because what's done is done. And we can go back and try and fix it. But really, I prefer to learn from other people's mistakes, but I insist that we learn from our own. So that's just like going forward in that engagement, let's just keep that in mind. I know that this committee won't be necessarily the committee's deciding that, but let's take the lessons learned. So that's the first thing I wanted to say. The second thing I wanted to mention, again, with the points for deeper affordability at the state, I think that is true with the 4% LIHTC when it was non-competitive. I know there are the 9% for years used that average AMI target and would give you more points the lower your average AMI. And so if you look at 9% buildings versus 4% buildings, you'll see a different mix of AMI. And again, it's just the developer is going to do whatever the funding is telling them they have to do. And so we can solve this problem in the future through policy. And then I had a few, those are just some suggestions and what I'm hearing. I think as a affordable housing developer myself, it's really important to me that our projects are serving the communities that we intend for them to serve. It's really important that we're not giving lip service to diversity, equity, inclusion, and justice, that we're actually doing the work and we're learning from our mistakes. And no, you know, I'm certainly not perfect when it comes to any of that. But like I said, I prefer to learn from other people's mistakes. That's, you know, great. But I do insist that I learn from my own. And so that's, I think, you know, we've all been in this learning process together. There hadn't ever been a Metro or Portland bond before. This is all new. This committee is new. The preference policy is new. The preference policy is such a success that it's listed in HUD's handbook, in their DEI handbook, as a suggestion for other jurisdictions. Like, it is a success. Did we do it perfectly? No. Can we fix it? Yes, but I do want to point out that it's a huge success. It's a huge success a huge percentage of the homeowners that we have created with the preference policy are Black. That was the intention. And we were able to do that without running afoul of fair housing law. It's a huge accomplishment. And so I just want to highlight the successes as well, because I know there's problems and we can't let it go. We can't just say, we don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak. Okay, so my questions on the secure. yeah.
I'd like to respond to two things. First of all, the math question you started at the beginning with is exactly right. So first of all, thank you for that. The very first thing we did with the developers was we said, this is a math problem. This is a $300 a month problem per unit, roughly, for a three-bedroom, but it varies by the size of the unit. Tell us every single one of your vacancies, and we will look for funding to buy down that gap. And working with Leslie, found the funding to buy down the gap, and we have offered that to the developer. So we have said, we will fix this problem. We want you to lease to the preference policy list. We will provide the gap funding. So the answer is, we did exactly what you asked us to do. So I want you to know that we're trying to actually come up with real immediate solutions. Implementing it is harder than it looks. Never that easy. There's a lot of decisions that have to get made by tenants and others. But I just wanted to say, we understand that this is a fixable problem, and we went out immediately to find resources to fix it. I will say, and the funding that we found was CDBG, federal dollars, and right now I'm being pressured to use CDBG for shelter care. So there's a lot of tensions between important, you know, life and death uses for these funds. So we're really trying just to hold the line on the preference policy. Secondly, as someone who came from a city that has a history of racial discrimination, does not have any kind of thing like the preference policy, I am utterly in awe of the incredible work of the preference policy here in Portland. I have come here, I actually think this is one of the most important pieces of work that's I've seen done in any city, and I am deeply committed to making it work. I think it works incredibly well on the homeownership side, and we have fixes to make on the rental side. And so I think you're exactly right. You know, hindsight's 2020. We should have had a different rule in the bond. We should have just done the bond differently. We should have agreed we were going to have a little bit fewer units because we needed to deepen the affordability instead of doing all 60% units. But we are learning a lesson from this. And so I just want to make sure that you know we hear it. And I am so proud of the work of the preference policy team. I'm so glad we're in this fight, that you are all paying attention to this, because you're going to drive forward in great policy, I think, in the coming, as we engage in the TIF districts. I think that was the point I was trying to make, is we hear you and we are trying to take this lesson and learn it. So I just want you to know that.
But I would be remiss to miss this opportunity, because Julian also said something else. You know, when they first started going to the moon, they lost some pilots. It wasn't the pilots' fault. So what I want to do is also support those early people who came in on this process and started this out and were pioneers in this, is that they're not pariahs. They didn't make mistakes necessarily on their own. So I want to make sure that they get the kudos that they need, that to continue to redefine, stay invested, participate. So Julian, I do appreciate you pointing out that portion of it. Thank you.
I did have a question. So this gets a little bit more into the operation stuff, Devisha, that you were talking about. When does PHB get notified that there's an upcoming vacancy? And what I mean is the unit already vacant? Or are you notified when someone gives notice?
I wish we were notified when someone gave notice, because that would give more time for me to notify people of the opportunity. We get it when it's vacant. And lately, to Leslie's note, had a meeting to ask if we can get the number of days that's vacant with the request. That has been like pulling teeth. So I can't give you a right answer, because I want to give you the correct answer. But most of them, some providers have provided me with the dates. I don't want to make it seem like everyone's not. And it's already vacant, in short, to answer your question. It has been vacant for some time.
So it seems like that's something to work on, especially as you're revamping the process, that when you get notification that there's a unit that's going to become vacant, you start the right. If it's a 60-day process and they give 30 days notice, and we're not using that 30 days to start screening people, we're losing time. And so that seems like a training issue, so to speak.
Yeah.
And one, clearly you're already on top of.
Well, we have to work on the like policy behind that first. I'm doing a lot of work in the manual, but yes, sorry.
Yeah. And then my last thing was just on the security deposit. And you said that folks, the struggle was getting the security deposit funds in time to move in. Is there a way that that either PHB or United Way could provide some sort of commitment letter so that the developer or the housing association would know the money is coming in the next, you know, 2 weeks, 30 days, whatever, so that that person doesn't have to wait to move in?
Yes, the wait isn't so much like United Way slowing down to get the money. They have a pretty good turnaround time. I'll have that in the comprehensive report, how long it takes them. We'll ask that question there. It's mostly in that by the time the person actually like is able to commit, there's such a short window of time. And before, it was a confusion on the language of intent to lease, even though that was expressed in an actual lease. Mm. A lot of folks, and that was the training disconnect. That's why we did a lot of retrainings. That was the training disconnect there is the language read as we need a lease agreement. And if you need the lease agreement, a person's usually moving in and getting keys by the time they sign the lease agreement. So that's where part of the disconnect was. We did have a successful run with Cascadia BHC doing it. That was phenomenal. And I will point and say that I do believe that vacant was maybe a few days to becoming vacant. It wasn't a huge amount of time, even just a bit of notice is helpful. But it wasn't a unit that they knew 30 days in advance that it was going to become vacant. She very much was like, yeah, I think I have one coming up. It's going to be a few weeks. And they followed the process to a T. So she very much understood it was the intent to lease that we were trying to push for. So even just this person wants this unit, they passed the first phase of mm-hmm. the screening portion. Now you're just assessing the background components. It depends on their process for them. They did the income screening, which I believe is standard, and then they followed through with the background because they have to do a criminal background check. And it was in that first phase that they knew when they sent the letter right off Great. The United Way. So that would be a good solution for it.
Great. Thank you. And I just, the last thing I just want to close with is vacancies and back owed rent in affordable housing developments is a nationwide problem. It is not a northeast problem. It is in affordable housing coming out of the pandemic. It has been a challenge, not just in Portland, not just in Northeast Portland, but across the country. And so there are broader solutions. There are national solutions and local solutions. But I just want everyone, if you are, I'm an affordable housing developer, so I track it a lot. But if you aren't tracking it and you're just hearing about it in this meeting, I just want you to know that while the preference policy, you know, is and working through the administration of that is certainly something we want to strive for. The high vacancies, the difficulty getting in, the difficulty paying security deposits is right now, and the back owed rent is a nationwide problem that we're all facing as affordable housing developers. So I just want to make it really clear that certainly I don't think anyone should think that the preference policy is solely responsible for some of the financial struggles of our nonprofit partners.
Thank you very much. And we're going to hear from the rest of the team for sure. I want to say this, as we have put agendas together for and then put timelines associated with them. Historically, there were times when I would drive our agenda around our timelines. At this point, some of the topics necessitate that we engage and that we process. So if you're watching or if you're tracking and you're going, my God, you're way past your time. Yeah, we are past our time, but from my perspective, this is the necessity of the work that we're involved in. And it is a value that is worth taking the time to process and engage around. So with that being said, Ms. Virgie, comments, thoughts?
I appreciate the discussion here tonight and all the suggestions. It's on a more positive, upbeat, like we haven't sunk the ship yet. People are in apartments and are staying there for the most part. The things that are happening to people's income going down, expense never went down. So there has to be another way. And I'm glad we're looking at other options, doing the research. And I really like the work that I'm hearing from the Housing Bureau, from our affordable developer here, and the rest of the committee. Just keep on keeping on, because people need affordable housing, and that's what we're here for.
Very much. Ramon, comments?
The only question I have is there a...
Oh, sorry. Is there anything part of the point system that has like a move-in readiness
when you were thinking about like stale leads or like, I know like people can kind of stay on the list if they get a call and they're not wanting to move into that unit or that complex, but is there a option for a move-in readiness? So when you guys are going through that screening, you guys know these people are ready to move in. So vacancies aren't going on for days or weeks or months.
There isn't like a move-in readiness assessment. I think the closest thing to maybe what I'm understanding you're asking is the what we're trying to do, which is the first touch, just gauging interest, right? In full transparency, we were missing a lot of data. We were not collecting a lot of information because there was hesitancy in this being one of the first kind of programs of this time. And I came in 2016, because Omari's eight. So I came in 2016 and they, I remember being like warned almost, you know, like New York is being sued and stuff. Like preference policy wasn't as hot. So a lot of hesitancy around collecting certain data was the reason why we weren't collecting like AMI preferences or which essentially determines their readiness and part of their readiness into moving, or if they certain bedroom counts. There were attempts, very shaky attempts through by way of forms, but responsiveness was very low. The same unresponsiveness that developers were seeing, we were seeing as well. So there is just maybe with through the first touch, but there isn't any further like assessment explored yet. But I'll defer to Leslie to see if that's something the committee might be considering.
Well, I think that's something that we can look at as part of this review process. And because the main reason why we don't do a lot of assessment around their readiness is because then they have to go through the same thing, a lot of the same questions with the development partner when they're going through the screening process and all of these things. And we didn't want people to have to answer the same questions multiple times, because even if we get their information and we say, oh, this person is at 56% or they're at 60% AMI and this and this and this, depending upon what the funding stack is for that particular building, they may have additional criteria, additional information that they're going to require. And now we've traumatized somebody by saying, oh, they're 60%. But when the building calculates it, it comes out to be 62%. And now they're over income. So we really have to balance our request for information with what the buildings then have to ask as well. And so, but again, that's something that we can consider as we are reviewing the preference policy, what we have the capacity to do. We have a partnership with Planning and Sustainability. They create the map and the application on our website for us. So if there's required like reprogramming, we have, you know, we pay them to do that for us. And unless we're going to like outsource that someplace else, which could be a consideration, we are having to collect information as we get responses from people like, hey, you know, I want a 2-bedroom and I have 3 kids and whatever else, those pieces of information, so that we can better match those folks on the list to the units that are available.
Thank you very much.
And if I may, sorry, to that, San Francisco does one element of kind of a pre-assessment that they do. They do it with about 10 times as many people as we have. So there is that possibility in other preference policies. I just wanted to throw that out there so everyone.
Yeah, 10 more staff than we have. So to be clear.
Thank you, Kevin.
No extra questions for me.
Okay. Any questions from our team remote? I'll start with you, Celie.
No, I don't have any questions. I just want to say I appreciate the conversation. And when there is a private conversation to be had, I would love to be a part of that.
Absolutely. Tanisha?
Yeah, I'm going to agree with Celie. I really appreciate the conversation and all the additional knowledge that has been shared. Thank you so much. But I don't have any questions at this time.
Thank you. Thanks, Davisha. I'm sure you thought, hey, I'm going to 5 minutes and we're good.
I'll just have to answer to Omari. I'm good. Thank you.
We do want to, and I realize we are at 737. I understand that. And thank you, Habitat, for hanging out. Yeah, come on up. much to talk about. Great updates, I'm sure. And then we've got a few questions that we will engage. So thank you. And everyone who can hang out and stay, we welcome you to do so. We're going to forego our communications newsletter tonight. And we will still have space for public comment before our wrap up. So
there's actually nobody signed up for
public comment. No one signed up. So
that works.
We will have no public comment tonight. So introduce yourself and present, please.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for having me back. I'm Ian Alger. I'm the project manager at Habitat for Humanity, working on the Cary Boulevard project. We've got a little presentation, Norma, if you're able to get that up. We were last here in July, so some time has passed and we've made some progress on the design. So you can hop right into the next slide. So just wanted to do a little background of where we've come from and where we're going. 2023 is when Habitat received the green light to work on this project. We spent that year kind of learning about the limitations and constraints of what we could do with the site. We spent 2024 engaging with the North Northeast community, first through a survey and then an event. So I think about 180 people responded to the survey. We had 50 people right here in this room for an event this past summer, asked for some input about the design. And then we spent the fall finalizing the design documents with our architect and civil engineer. We're actually preparing in 2 weeks to submit for permits. So the first one that we'll be going for is called a phased utility permit, which covers all the grading and underground utilities. As you'll see on a later slide, it's quite a large site, about 3 acres. We're going to spend almost a year working on excavation and all that stuff. We're supposed to get the land from PHP in July. Right now it is occupied as a safe rest village. So we're going to be coordinating with the Safe Rest Village team this spring to work on transitioning the site. I understand that they're working with all of the folks who are living there currently on individualized plans to find somewhere for them to move to. And then in August, we hope to have permits in hand and be ready to start excavation. Next slide. So this is just the overview of the site plan. Actually, why don't we go to the next slide? I like the next one a little bit better. Gives you kind of a bird's eye view. So it's 50 homes. We have 22 bedrooms, 19 three bedrooms, and 11 four bedroom homes. So some family sized homes in here with a range of from 35% to 80% AMI. And the one of the things that we asked about in the community engagement was what to do with some of these green spaces on site, what kind of amenities people wanted to see. We heard overwhelmingly an interest in garden space and a play area, as well as picnic area. So those pop-outs there on the slide are showing our landscape architect was able to put together a little gardening area with some fruit trees in that central area. We're expecting to have an accessible little play area. And then over on the left there is where there's actually a giant heritage tree, a really tall redwood. So that area is, we can't really, you know, impact it all. So it's perfect actually for just like a little path and some like picnic area. Why don't we go on to the next slide? This is just a close-up kind of conceptual view of some of the amenities that we're designing. That's the green space and play area on the right, and then the raised garden beds and fruit trees on the left. And then I think the last slide, I have just more next steps. So like I said, we're applying for the utility permit this month. We estimate around 6 months for city review. It's not quite as involved of a process as the full building permit and site development permit review. But we're budgeting some time for a few rounds of revisions. Get the land in July, start work in August. We're expecting around a year for site development. As you saw on that site plan, there's a whole new public road that we're constructing, North Minerva. Ready to start vertical construction summer 2026 and selling homes 2028 to 2029. So I know that it's been kind of a it's been almost 2 years, you know, since we started, but that was part of the plan the whole time. I think that the Safe Rest Village has been a big success, and it's been really cool to be a part of what is kind of a new model of let's use this land that we have to house people temporarily while we design, you know, permanent community. So, we welcome questions. I saw there was a whole hour for me on the agenda, but let's see what happens, I guess.
We'll toss the grenade in the air to the gallery view, please. And I will begin with our remote team. Tanisha, Renee, you have any questions?
I don't have any questions.
Okay, thank you. Saylee?
No questions.
Okay, thank you. And I will come this way. This time we'll start with you, Kim.
Thanks. I guess, so I'm relatively new to this committee. Like, obviously this is a pretty long process. Is there any part of this process that you feel like, or we feel like as a group, like is taking way too long through this, or is this like expected through the processes that we have today?
I think it's been just about the right amount of time to do a really engaged design process. So we can definitely get through design a lot faster, but I think it was great that we had the time because of the Safe Rest Village to slow down and really do a thorough survey, a community engagement process, have the event this summer. There's also been a few surprises along the way as far as learning about what sort of public improvements we had to do. There was a pretty involved process with the Urban Forestry Department and learning about how to work kind of around the trees on the site. So I think that we really benefited, honestly, from having the Safe Rest Village there and having this plan of July 2025 is when we're going to go, because it gave us a little cushion to absorb some of those surprises that happen anytime you're designing a big project like this.
That's a great question. I don't know, Ms. Goodlow, if you want to speak to this at all as it relates to some of the conversations we've had as an oversight committee about how processes unfold. And so I will come in with comment as well regarding that. But
sir, I'll just jump in for Kevin and Ramon's benefit. This has been a long process. We purchased this property from the Water Bureau, I believe in 2016. And we had been, you know, trying to figure out what was going to be the best timing, given everything else that was going on. We, you know, prioritized the bond projects as we had the Metro Bond and the Portland Bond. And so there was really no rush for this for us to get started on this home ownership project, but we have had the land for a while. We did that RFP, and Habitat was the successful project. And so, you know, projects, you know, depending upon the scope and the size, you know, generally take, as Jillian said, they can take up to 5 years from design concept to funding to shovels in the ground and then leasing. And so we knew that this was going to take a while, which is one of the reasons why we started with the folks. We did a run of the home ownership preference policy because we wanted people to be ready when the units were ready. And given that we saw in the last couple rounds that people were taking, you know, upwards 3-4 years to get mortgage ready, that we didn't want folks to miss out on this project or this opportunity because they didn't have enough time to get where they needed to go. So this has been a great partnership with Habitat on this project. It definitely is, as I have mentioned before, a project from the heart This is creating a neighborhood for people that have some who have never thought about being homeowners, and families that have never had a homeowner, or who the last homeowner was four generations ago. And so this is critically important for us to ensure that we are meeting this, both the spirit and the guidance that the community gave to us in 2014 when we started this process. Is creating new homeowners was a priority. And this is one of the major projects that will increase that commitment or meet that commitment.
Thank you very much. A little supplemental information alongside that. One of the things we discovered is, and Leslie highlighted it, how long it takes for people to get into the space where they can purchase. And it was important for us to do some collaborative and coordinating effort so that we could, as much as possible, support some seamlessness so that as opportunities are happening, the people who can benefit from those opportunities are ready to take advantage of them. Our lived experience, especially here in the city of Portland, is the systems or policies that get established to help people who are most impacted. If those people who are most impacted aren't ready to take advantage of those opportunities, other people get them. And we want to not be responsible for putting forth quite a bit of work, creating an environment that then doesn't benefit the very people we're fighting to help benefit from that environment. And so part of our process and part of our hope and part of our strategy is to think through how that happens. What's good and what's different about, and I'm hoping it's going to be good, it's going to be interesting for a while until it gets smoothed out. When this started, when we began doing what we're doing, the experience of the city and this collaborative work that now is happening was not happening. The city was very siloed, and left hand didn't necessarily work with the right hand. And so it required a different level of engagement and strategy, et cetera, that we put ourselves into in various spaces at various times to advocate for those who didn't have a chance to advocate for themselves. And so some of this timing is associated with that. Hopefully going forward, there will be more of a collaborative and strategic, intentional thoughtfulness to ensure that the people who've been, again, most impacted get to benefit from the work that we're doing.
Thank you all. That was very helpful. It seems like an awesome project. So thank you.
You bet, Ramon.
No questions.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Virgie.
Yes, I wanted to look at this from the standpoint of this organization, Habitat for Humanity. Have you run into problems where your clients that you work with can't pay their rent? What do you do?
Thanks for that question. We get that one a lot. Let me backtrack. I didn't really even introduce Habitat or talk about, you know, who we are and what we do. So we develop affordable home ownership purely. We are 100% home ownership organization. So people are purchasing their homes from us with a mortgage set at 30% of their income. The majority of the homes will be affordable to folks making 35 to 60% of AMI, and some between 60 and 80 as well. We have very, very few people default on those mortgages. I think it's like 98, 99%. So it's extremely high. It's very, very rare for that to happen.
Is it my understanding that the mortgages are actually tailored to the individual and their income?
Yeah, that's correct. Yes. So the idea is that their monthly payment will be affordable at that 30% level. So that we have kind of a range of homes that we're expecting are going to sell to somebody between the 35 and 60% range. But if you come in making, 60K, we're going to set it at 30%, of what you can pay. It's not like a rental where the same rent is set for every single home.
Thank you. And John, I've not forgotten you. I will come back to you. Jillian?
I don't think I have any questions at this time.
Awesome. Akiba?
I really like this project. And just looking at the picture, is there like a community swimming pool in that area?
I think, yes, I see there's a swimming, that's the neighbor's swimming and
that's,
pool.
Okay. So, so there won't be like the community to have a special place for them to meet other than the park and play area?
Yeah, our hope is that those the three spaces that I highlighted will kind of be a place where you can gather. The place around the redwood tree is pretty large. So if there was a community gathering, I guess that could happen there. The place with the play area, that's a little narrower. It's kind of, you know, between the buildings. But I think that there's a couple good spots that'll facilitate connection.
And I think with the time, by the time is done, hopefully you'll be able to have some people recruited that will be able to have to afford to buy those houses within our community, right? That's all.
John, you are on the screen.
I'm on the screen. You see me on the screen. Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I remember when Leslie and those guys were scrambling to get that Water Bureau property up there and to do some of the work. And it was interesting that Habitat got the contract to do that. And so congratulations. But, you know, something has just been interesting to me. Just recently over the new year, there was a troubling article that came out about you guys. Well, can you talk to me a little bit about what that article was all about?
Sure, I'd be happy to respond to that. I think you're referring to there was an article and news report from COIN suggesting there was a homeowner at one of our communities who was concerned. They thought that it was not built to fire code. It was disappointing to see that report come out that way because it's not true. Every community that we build is permitted through the city of Portland, reviewed for compliance with code, inspected for compliance with code. And we have 100% certainty that that project is fine. So it's unfortunate, I guess, that there was that misunderstanding and then misinformation that came out in that news story, but you can have 100% confidence that this project will be permitted by the city of Portland. It will be constructed and inspected by the city of Portland, and it will meet all fire code rules.
I appreciate that. I appreciate you sharing that with me. That's all I had.
Okay. Thank you very much. I was going to address not just that, but questions in regard to, thanks John for raising it. Questions in regard to the streets that are being created. Do you know the width of the street? And it looks like we have what is a cul-de-sac in the community that leads into parking structures. And in light of emergency respondents, in light of fire departments, in light of et cetera, talk to me a little bit about the strategy in that regard.
So we have a great page in the plans, which I don't have in this presentation, but one of the pages that we'll be submitting to the city as part of the utility permit actually shows the pathway of a fire truck with aerial fire apparatus, how it can turn into and out of each of those parking areas. Because on this project, due to the configuration and the zoning, that is a requirement that each of those parking areas has access for one of the long trucks with the, you know, ladders on top. So yes, it has been designed according to the PBOT specifications, and there's room for a full fire truck to get into each of those parking areas. And the Yeah, the cul-de-sac was, that's an interesting part of the design. Again, that was required by PBOT with, you know, adequate radius and whatnot. Getting a little bit out of my depth and into the civil engineer land, but I appreciate it. North Minerva Street there is wide enough for two-way traffic and parallel parking on both sides as well.
That's what I was going to ask. I didn't notice. I was counting the parking spaces and then the units, and there's obviously going to be some street parking, or that it will necessitate street parking. So I appreciate it. And just a further question, I know it might be a little bit beyond your specific space, but around the, or still in line with emergency respondents, are there going to be certain spaces that are do not park spaces? Are they going to be identified, or is that something you don't know yet?
That's a good question. I'm looking at the site plan, and I can see that, like, in the parking areas, we do have a few spots that are marked as ADA accessible spots with a striped out area next to them. Any of the curbs there where there is no parking shown will have signage saying no parking. Fire lane, I believe. I was just reviewing the design set that's going in the other day, and I'm pretty sure that was mentioned, but that will get that level of detail will get dialed in more at the next round of permitting. So getting a little into the weeds, but what we have right now with the utility permit covers just the grading and underground utilities. The flat work, basically the paving, the concrete curbs, the sidewalks, the landscaping, that'll get handled in a later permit called a site development permit. So at that point, we'll know for sure. The city will tell us, here is exactly what you need to do. And there's a whole host of things. It could be you need to put signs up. It could be you need to paint the curbs. We're not sure yet. Mm. And we'll have to see what the city dictates.
These buildings don't require sprinkler systems, do they?
Good question. There actually is one building that's going to have sprinklers. So the one that is, if you know, have your printed out here in front of you, near the tree on the far left, that building in the far left corner, building one, mm-hmm. It's far enough away from the drivable surface where like a fire truck could be. That it does have to have sprinklers in it.
Okay, the one by the big tree.
That's right. Just that fourplex.
Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Further questions, comments from the team?
Saley unmuted. I'm not sure if she has a question.
Saley, hi.
No, he answered it for me. Thank you for that, though.
Absolutely. Tanisha?
No questions.
Awesome. Fantastic. Ms. Goodlow, any comment? You're still muted.
I just wanted to put it out there that if there are oversight committee members that would like to go out and tour the site, Dr. Holt and I were able to do that back in the summer or last spring. I don't know. It was sometime in last year. I think it would be good for people to get a feel for what the site looks like as much as you can, because the Safe Rest Village is still there. But at least you could see it, that area where that heritage tree is would be a great place for, you know, a community picnic or something for the people that live there. If they wanted to have some kind of event or something, that's a large space that would be available to the folks that live there. But people can just let me know, and we can work with Habitat to schedule a site tour.
Excellent. Two things then as we're wrapping up. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for your involvement. Great presentation.
Thank you. Thanks,
amazing we were able to get through all that we got through. Several of you know that former President Jimmy Carter was very involved and a strong advocate for Habitat for Humanity for decades. One of the greatest programs that have created home ownership opportunities for Black and brown people in the nation. Habitat has done incredible work. And so glad to see this opportunity coming online and the possibility that will help create community. I'm looking forward to others. And ownership is a passion of my heart. It does so much for value, sustainability, family consistency, health and wellness. We could go on and on and on, economic opportunity, et cetera. Related to the communications newsletter, Ms. Gwynn will email the Oversight Committee and let us know. It was in regard to the January newsletter that's coming out. And Helmy will be, the director will be writing the welcome letter. And so we're trying to highlight some of the great things that are going on that we've been involved in. I have said for a long time, I think we've been too quiet. I think that what this committee has accomplished and done has not received the amount of notification and awareness that it should. To that extent, then, we, in our next meeting, our next gathering, we're going to be celebrating 10 years. So the March meeting will not be a meeting. The March meeting will be our 10-year anniversary and celebration. Pretty phenomenal to think of going from what was $20 million in the initial investment to over $100 million to and the priorities that we had, what we've been able to do to help people stay in their homes, establishing a sustainable process to help people stay in place, the land banking that we were involved in, the affordable rental units that have been built, the homes that have been established, and then the amount of people who now are homeowners. I think it's a story that should be told. I think it's something we should yell about. And so absolutely celebrate. More information will be coming. And we'll get a chance to advertise and let other people know and invite them in to the space to with streamers and banners and balloons popping and fireworks going off. Maybe not fire. Well, why not? You're shaking your head now. You're shaking your. You're not the boss of me. Is there anything else that you would add anyone about the tenure?
Well, I'll just add real quick. We've tentatively set for the March date. So I think it's March 13th is the date that we're looking at, which is ironically like the last day that the city was open when we were getting ready to celebrate the 5-year, and we had to cancel because of COVID. So it's kind of ironic that that's the date that I believe we're looking at. But we will be reaching out to all of our current and past Oversight Committee members. We really want to celebrate everyone that has participated, our community partners that have built buildings, that have done home repair, that have worked with us over the last 10 years. Hopefully, past Commissioner Saltzman. Mm-hmm. And our past directors that were supportive of this, particularly Tracy Manning, who was the director at the time that helped get this over the finish line. So be looking for information. I know a couple folks said that they were interested in working on the planning. If you haven't, email, if you could send Gwynn an email and let her know. I do want to send a thank you to those of you that said you were available to help with interviews to fill that preference policy position. And then last but not least, our annual report to council, we will need to get that done sometime in the spring. I will have all of the data by the end of February. And so I'll be reaching out to folks to help craft the narrative that goes along with the data. So if you are at all interested in that, I will send out the data. And if you have comments or if there's anything in particular that you think that we should highlight from 2024, please let me know. And other than that, Happy New Year, everybody, and be safe.
Thank you very much. I think I started by saying, or one of the things I started with, was about creating the atmosphere or the environment that's equitable. And so we are thoughtful around food. Well, we're going to have a spread at the 10-year anniversary. So you can tell your friends and family, bring your neighbors along. It's going to be some great food and some delicious desserts. So big celebration. Something to make noise about. I appreciate your investment to all of those who are part of the committee. Happy New Year. Thank you for continuing to work and roll your sleeves up and make a difference. We are doing that. To all the partners, Portland Housing Bureau, and the electeds that continue to support our work, we appreciate you too. Have a good night, everybody. Take care.
Thank you.
Interesting. Mm-hmm.